pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Greg Rourke. Starting with the present and working backward, for the last 11 years, Greg has been director of the USDA National Agroforestry Center, which is mostly here in Lincoln on East Campus, although Greg lives in Huntsville, Alabama. He, prior to that, was with the USDA Forestry Office in Washington as coordinator of biodiversity and tropical forestry programs, and also served in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy during the Clinton administration. Prior to that, he was a program leader looking at forest soil productivity. His PhD includes majors in forest ecology and soil service from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and prior degrees in forestry are from the University of Massachusetts. So, Greg.
Good. Thank you, Laurie. Thanks for showing up. It's really a treat for me to be back here. I lived here until about 4 years ago, and then I got relocated to Alabama. It's a little warmer there, although I must say I preferred living here. So it's always a treat to come back here. The National Agroforestry Center is here on the East Campus. I'm the director of that center. And we also do some things, since it's a national center, in the Southeast and in other parts of the country, too. Well, I wanted to talk today about trees and kind of go back in time and say, you know, were there many trees in the Great Plains, particularly along the rivers? So we're really talking about the river corridors and along these streams. And how far back do we go to try to figure that out? Now, when I lived here, I heard, and I expect most of you have heard, that there weren't trees here. There were buffalo here, certainly. A lot of grass, and it was just this big sweeping plain. And I was a little confused by that, because it seemed to me there might have been at least a couple trees here. And I was reading a book, and this is a book called The Contested Plains. And the author here is Elliot West. He's a historian in the University of Arkansas. And he was writing this from a different vantage point. What he was trying to say is, let's talk about the gold rush that happened in 1859 in Colorado, Denver area, Pikes Peak. And instead of looking at that, because that's been done to death, let's talk about the land that got rushed through. Nebraska and Kansas and parts of Colorado. What happened is all these people moved through there, and he went back further to kind of look at that too. So as I was reading this, I kept hearing about how folks would cut the trees down. They would move through the trees, they'd camp in the trees, and I said, there's a lot going on here with trees. So I got a hold of him, we talked to each other, and we decided to write a paper with him kind of handling the history part. So I'm not the historian, as you heard, my background is in forestry and soil science. There is a paper back there that we reproduced that was in the Journal of Soil Water Conservation. I think I got about 50 copies of it. There's more than that here if you wanted them. It's also something that's a PDF file we can make available to people if you want to print it out yourself or however you guys want to make that available. So let's kind of talk about this a little bit. We know where trees and shrubs occur on watercourses, that environmentally they tend to play a very important ecological role. And we'll talk at the end about what some of those roles might be, but for the most part, they're not just decorating the stream, although some people would say it looks very aesthetic. There's usually an ecological role function being played by that, and that's true of a lot of plants, particularly if they're native to a system. So historically, if we want to talk about, you know, what was out there, it depends to a very large degree on what reference point we choose. You know, we didn't have photography way back. We started to have photography at the turn of the in the late 1800s, so we've got some things documented there. But for the most part, I think this is the large part of the debate. How far do you go back? Now, when you do that, you're usually looking at anecdotal accounts. And I'll have some of that here, and that's a lot of what I've drawn upon. Scouting parties and survey parties, military surveys, things that went out, things that they recorded and kind of tying those to pieces, parts of the land where they saw things at. So let's talk about the Great Plains. And what I found is that along many of the major rivers and tributaries, trees were very common. And there were, in many cases, very wide-reaching swaths of trees in these riparian areas. Riparian simply referring to land that's adjacent to a water body. And this is kind of a starting point. Around 1800, we really started picking up a lot of pressure on these systems. And let's talk about why that happened. Let me go back one. In 1840, it picked up even more. And these are some of the things we'll cover here. The Indians, and a lot of folks may not think about that, but there was a lot of pressure put on by the Indians, particularly as they developed a culture based very much around horses. Pioneer, traffic over the overlands, miners. I mentioned the Denver Gold Rush. It was won in 1849 in California. Military forts, settlers, and then the railroad. So we'll talk a little bit about each of those. So if we go back, now this isn't really a long, long time in terms of history for some folks, but for the Great Plains, it's pretty far back in that from this point on, a lot of things have happened. In the last 200 years, huge changes to our landscapes. So if we look at Zebulon Pike, he went up the Arkansas River, and I'll show you some maps later where the different rivers are laid out so you can kind of get oriented. But he talked about the riverbanks being entirely covered with woods on both sides, just west of the present Colorado border. All right. Some of you might have been out there, ask yourself, are there a lot of trees there now? Not a lot. Then we come up a little further in time, 1821. A fellow, Jacob Fowler, talked about thickly wooded islands, points of timber in the bends on the Arkansas River. So that's a river that's kind of in the central southern Kansas running through. So you see, back in the early 1800s, we're getting anecdotal reports of trees from these parties going out. 1825, and we're going to kind of chronologically move up through time a little bit. Near Great Bend, Kansas, there were trees lining, and these things were named things like Walnut Creek, Ash Creek. So again, the names themselves indicating there were timber on those. And these streams are described as having and being well shaded by stands of hardwoods, and that they spotted other wooded tributaries downstream. 1835, Henry Dodge, a name that is familiar to a lot of folks in Nebraska, started talking about the Platte River. Now, the Platte River was one of the first ones to get traversed as people decided to move out west. Very easy to travel, very flat landscape. But he talked about the Platte River above the heavily timbered Grand Island. Who's been to Grand Island? Okay, heavily timbered? Not so much today. So it had abundant trees on the south bank, feet of ravines covered with small timber growth. Some of this you can kind of read, I'll just paraphrase, but he could see more timber off in the distance, scattered groves as he looked out from there. So again, 1835, that's a lot further back than we normally look. 1843, Charles Fremont, down on the Republican and Solomon Rivers, noted, again, handsomely timbered lands, and described the soil. They were looking, a lot of these scouting parties are saying, could settlers move here? Is it good farmland? Is there timber to build houses for fuel wood, to cook fire? I mean, is it a place you could actually settle and have resources in order to live? Now, 1857, not a lot longer. Still, from our point of view, a ways back. Now we start seeing people talking differently a little bit. We see driftwood being mentioned. We see things being mentioned along the Republican. But we're starting to see, and we'll start to see, I think, in the next slide, that people start to mention it's going away. There isn't as much. It's starting to dwindle on us. So this period here, 40-year period, a lot of folks going through, I cited some here. There are some others. There are many more in here. If you wanted to read this, there are obviously other things you could read besides this. But what you kind of see is a pattern. In 1820, 1840, 1845, a lot of mention of these parties going through, kind of the first incursion of the settlers going through, Europeans going through, saying, hey, a lot of trees out here. Looks pretty good. Then around 1840 and a little after that, people start saying, they're being cut, they're being used. Of note is that there are three areas talked about as being big timber areas. One on the Arkansas, the big timbers of the Arkansas, big timbers of the Smoky Hill, and then the Republican River. And give you some orientation on the map here. So you can see Nebraska sitting up there. The 10, 11, and 12 that are in red, those are areas that were described as having very large timbers up in the headwaters of some of these major rivers. And for reference, you can see the Platte River going through Nebraska. the North Platte, Lodgepole Creek. A lot of these things were ones that were mentioned in some of the quotes I showed in previous slides and some I'll show in upcoming slides of streams and tributaries where they were noting that there was abundant timber on. And the story that comes out is, you know, as you can imagine, trees were very important to everybody. And if we just start here with Indians, the horses that began to dominate the plains, horses came into North America through the Spaniards coming into Mexico about the middle of the 1500s, but they really didn't get up into the plains areas until about 1680. And some of them were wild and breeding on their own. A lot of tribes were picking those up and beginning to use the horse. But that's when they started coming on. And in particular, what we want to do is talk about the Cheyennes. I'm going to mainly focus on this tribe because they actually became the dominant tribe in the 1800s in the Great Plains and very much had a culture built around horses. Now, if you sit back around 1780, they had migrated from Wisconsin and Minnesota and kind of ended up in 1780 up in northern, or up in North Dakota, in the central part. But they had moved in where other tribes already existed. And so, as you can imagine, they weren't particularly welcome. They were there for a few years, but began to get a lot of hostilities from some of the neighboring tribes that ran them off. And then there was an epidemic. They're not really sure if it was a smallpox or a measles that came through. But they made a major decision as a tribe. At that point, they had been living in villages with thatched roofs and hunting and doing some horticulture and agriculture. But they made a decision to move out on the plains and actually become a nomadic tribe. And they were drawn by a couple things. The buffalo had already been depleted to some extent to the east of the Mississippi, but they were very plentiful out of the Great Plains. And they saw an opportunity to begin to dominate the trade between other tribes and the settlers coming through, because there were a lot of things that were very desirable to Indians. Things made of steel, fish hooks, I mean, huge improvement in efficiency if you get those. Metal scrapers for hides, metal awls in order to work the leather. So that there were trade goods like that, metal pots and pans. They were after those. They were also very interested in guns, which they could get from the British and the French. And then the horses, they were beginning to get increasing numbers from the Spanish and other Indian tribes. So they were drawn out into the Great Plains. And this is a map of where things kind of settled out. And I made it slightly larger circles, or more dominant circles. So you see the Cheyenne kind of here. So starting out here, moving across over to the Dakotas, then coming down and into this area here. You'll recognize names like Pawnee. Pawnee Lake is a lake around here. Some of these are tribal names you'll recognize. So when we talk about a horse culture, say, well, so what was that about? Well, the Cheyennes had many horses. In fact, the estimate is that they had anywhere from 6 to 12 horses on average per person in the tribe. The reason they had so many horses is since they were in the trade business, if they were hunting buffalo, they had to carry the hides. So many of those horses were just used to transport the hides so that when they came back from the front range, they could trade those for goods, trade them with other tribes, trade them with the settlers. And that changed their culture. So when you have that many horses, you can't just go down into the rivers in the winter months as a tribe and camp. You've got to really string out and spread yourself down those streams and for many, many, many miles in order to get the feed for your horses, in order to get dispersed along those. So they ended up kind of really behaving more in small cluster units, the Cheyenne did, because of the way they had to camp in the winters. And what would happen when the winters would get over in 3 or 4 months, they would tend to then move out and eventually try to get into the highlands where the grasses were coming up and there was water and they could then hunt the bison on the front range. So what you often hear is settlers would be coming through later on, they go, you know, we didn't see any Indians. You know, we were out there 4 or 5 maybe even 6 weeks that it took us to cross the Great Plains to get where we were going, whether it was Denver or someplace else, didn't encounter any Indians. Well, in the summer, the Indians tended to be on the Front Range. They weren't down along the rivers, at least not for a while. They ended up getting a little torqued because they come back in the winter and all the trees are gone. So there started to be some altercations that developed. And then they migrate in the autumn up the Far Creeks, but usually they would always manage to get back down into the rivers, the ones that I showed you on the map here, to do the overwintering. Again, just Cheyenne here. These are, this again in Elliot's book here, these are places where they have found sizable camps where the Cheyennes camped. So you see some of the rivers that I showed you earlier, the Platte going through here, Republican here. What I did here, this line here, is the 100th Meridian. A lot of folks kind of use that as a reference to say, well, you know, west of the 100th Meridian, you get a pretty marked drop-off in rainfall. Usually we're talking about going into irrigation systems there. To the east, you don't have so much. So just give you a reference point. But you see, strung out along those rivers in great numbers, and this is just one tribe. They weren't the only tribe in the area. So again, Fowler, and this is a guy who talked. Now, this is before we saw the trees really getting depleted in the different mentions we saw, but back in 1821, Fowler spotted one group of Indians camping along the Arkansas and said, you know, there's about 20,000 horses there. 20,000 horses. So a lot of horses. And then there were some other events that happened too. And this is referred to by the tribes as a great piece of, well, they didn't know it was 1840, but it happened in 1840. They didn't use the same calendar we were using. But on the upper Arkansas, there was a large area from the Front Range out to about the 100th Meridian that I showed you in the Colorado and Nebraska, where about half a dozen tribes contested that area as their hunting ground, as their camping ground. And constantly, if one went into there, there'd be a fight, there'd be a war. And by the way, most of the rifles that the Cheyenne and other Indians would trade for weren't used to hunt buffalo. That wasn't a very efficient way to hunt buffalo. Most of them rode their horses and had very, very powerful short bows that they could use to do that. The guns were usually used to fight each other. They're very good to stand off at a distance and shoot at each other. So when this great peace happened, good news is, you know, now they got along. They weren't fighting. The impact on the resource was they were all then at liberty to go into this large area and hunt as much buffalo as they wanted because they weren't going to contest each other being in there. And so it very much began to deplete in the buffalo. And about this time, a couple other things happened. The beaver trade had been very robust, but due to over-harvesting and also some habitat degradation, beaver trade started falling off too, so that put even more demand for buffalo robes, for the bison. And it also led to, I thought I'd give you some insight into the way things were, the dynamics in that time, trade marriages. And this was about a 20-year period where if you wanted to sort of be top dog in the plain, and you were a white settler, you would negotiate and you would marry an Indian princess from one of the tribes, because that then made you the broker. If the settlers wanted the trade or another tribe, they come to you, you negotiate the tribe because you had the relationship through your marriage with the Cheyenne or some of these other tribes, and that you were kind of very highly esteemed. 20 years later, what happened is as it became very clear that the settlement was going to stick. People were going to live in Denver, whether they found gold or not. You're going to have supply routes going to them. You're going to have to build forts to protect them. You're going to have trading posts. That all came undone because suddenly then there was an investment in permanent trading establishments and others that unseated these individuals who had these trade marriages, and they then almost went to the bottom of the heap socially. You know, the children were half-breeds. They weren't respected, that kind of thing. So just very, very rapid and interesting dynamics that were going on in the plains. I talked about 20,000 horses being camped along one stretch of the river. One reason that's an important thing to consider in the trees is the impact it had. 1845, this lieutenant here looked at it and he says, you know, when winters were tough, there wasn't much grass down the river to feed the horses. Now, half those horses didn't make it, by the way. On average, more than half of them would die, and so they ate a lot of horse meat, and I don't think they had horse sushi, so they probably were using fires to cook that horse meat. So again, reasons they would be cutting the trees down, but here's one example, and this was seen not just by him, as there's other accounts of this, where they would fall, these cottonwood trees, large trees, drop them on the ground in the winter, and then the horses could then eat the twigs and get some nourishment from that and stay alive. They had to carry at least a portion of those horses through into the spring, or they wouldn't have breeding stock and they wouldn't be able to continue the way that they hunted and the way that they traded on the plains. Here's another example. 80 miles along the South Platte and 20 miles up one of the creeks. And some people have tried to do calculations on this, but I just kind of summed it up by saying the amount of wood cut and burned was considerable. I mean, just imagine imagine yourself going camping for 3 to 4 months in the winter here in Nebraska, and it's cold, and you want to have a fire to stay warm, and you have some things you want to cook. Just one person, just one of you guys in a tent could chew up a fair amount of wood doing that. So when you have whole tribes doing that, now this we haven't even talked about the settlers yet. All we've talked about is, again, 1820 to about 1840, 1845, that early period where the Indians, which most people don't normally think of, were having a heavy impact on the resource, the trees along the streams. Winter, when the big cramps take place, that was what the Cheyennes, the Southern Cheyennes call it, the cholera epidemic came through. One of the things, you hear this all the time, when folks from one place, from Europe, come through and they have resistance to things like cholera and they encounter people, in this case, in native tribes, they had no exposure in the past and they were really decimated by cholera in this particular year here. So again, some of the dynamics that are going on the plains. And these particular years here, in this series here, there are some very, very rough droughts that came on. And these are records that you can get from tree rings and those kind of things. So very, very intense droughts. And one of the things that happened when these droughts would occur is if you were thinking about moving out into the Front Range and out into those big grasslands in the spring and the drought hit, you couldn't get very far because the grass didn't grow in the highlands, the ponds didn't fill up with water. And what tended to happen is they kind of hung back for longer periods along the rivers, and again, an even greater impact on the wood resources there. So settlers, and again, there's not many pictures in this presentation because they didn't have cameras in. So if you look at a lot of these anecdotal and try to pull out some exact quotes from people's journals and reports, Indian chief of the Arikasas, back in 1835, said, you know, your people are traveling all over this country and cutting the trees of our brothers. I don't know whether they are satisfied or not, but we have no land of our own. So that's when it was starting to be noticed. Going around 1840, in that period, you had a lot of settlers starting to push into these lands. Again, Dodge himself, he spent 20, 25 years out of the plains, starting back, I think, around 1825. So he was out there early on, and he observed that a day which would be death on the high plains may scarcely be uncomfortably cold in a thicket at the bottom of a deep, narrow canyon. Indians, plainsmen, and all indigenous animals understood this perfectly and fly to shelter at the first puff. So these areas were used by everybody, including the wildlife, to get cover. Some overland trails, this map's not the greatest, but you can see some of the ones, the Santa Fe Trail, Mormons going out to Utah, folks going out to the Oregon Trail. And what you notice, if we center on Nebraska, I don't have to point Nebraska out for you guys, right? So right, probably the first thing you spotted on there. So some trails running through there. So overland migration, how big was it? How many folks are coming through? Now, this is looking at the Pacific Coast. Not so much. 1840 is just starting to go. Remember Miner 49er and his daughter Clinton, the song? Well, 1849 was when they found gold out in California. So after this period, it really starts picking up. A little bit out to Utah, but not many. But 1849 gold rush, a lot of people. Okay. Fair amount going out to Utah, and many of them, because of the going out that way, were going along the Platte River. That was the northern route. That was the easiest way to get out there. Far easier than, I'll talk to you a little bit about, than say trying the Republican River or the Smoky Hill. But if you're going out to the Pacific Coast, that was a road to take. You couldn't really get lost. You just kind of just start following everybody else out. Most people would take off in the spring. Some would take off, you know, about now, try to get a jump on others. If they guessed wrong, sometimes they paid for it. Some would take off with, they had elaborate things. They even rigged up wagons and put sails on them, prairie schooners, and tried to sail them, and those didn't usually work out so well. And some of them disappeared. They don't know where they went. Some people would have pull carts. You could get one for $5 with a bar across and just pull your stuff. Others just a knapsack on their back, kind of like my teenage son would try. You know, some without very little preparation, some very, very elaborate. One guy had a piano without the legs on. He was trying to bring that out there. So, you know, all kind of interesting stories of what people tried to do. Most of them figuring they weren't coming back. They're going to take what they could. They're going to make a life for themselves out there. Now, part of this was also fed by the fact in 1857, there was a fairly substantial depression, economic depression, going on in the East and in the Midwest of the U.S., and a lot of people were fleeing that, trying to look for new opportunities. So, just overland migration, going out to the Pacific Coast in Utah, about 300,000 people, most of them happening in about a 10, 11-year period there. 1855, so this is in the middle of all that, we have somebody noting that along the entire Great Valley of the Platte, an immigrant noted that not a stick in the distance large enough for a switch. 5 years later, the explorer Richard Burden found that even islands were stripped of timber. So there are a number of accounts talking about how many of the islands, Grand Island was referenced, were covered with timber. Doesn't really surprise me, being a forester and being a person who studies soils, that if you're going to find trees in a reasonably dry environment, they're going to be in the wet, depressed areas where trees would normally come in and set up. 1859. Now, this is on top of the 300,000. These guys weren't heading west to the Pacific. They were heading to Denver. They found gold. Pike's Peak or bust. Everybody decided to drop everything they had in 1 year. 100,000 people, at least 100,000, decided to head up the Platte, mostly the Platte near Arkansas. And I'll show you the map of that. To a lesser extent, the Republican and the Smoky Hill Rivers heading out to Colorado. Some of them, you know, would take off early February. You're going to get that claim before somebody else gets it. There were also others that followed in subsequent years, because, you know, it went on for a few years, people thinking they're still going to find the gold. And in Montana, there were silver mines and other things being found out there. So in that period, essentially all trees that were in the Platte Valley were just stripped. There wasn't anything left. So a little bit of a summary here. 20-year period, 300,000 settlers coming across, heading out to California, Utah, Oregon. 1 year alone, in addition to that, another 100,000 going to Colorado. And kind of what you pick up is that, you know, the northern route, the Platte, people really found that early on. That was the way to get out west. Everybody here has probably driven I-80, and you know, it's very flat. It's very easy to traverse. So that would be the way to go, going out of Council Bluffs, hooking out of Nebraska City up into it, some people coming out of Kansas up into it. A southern route, again, also in fairly flat country, was your Arkansas. People taking out of Leavenworth, parts of Kansas, following along the Arkansas up here, and you can, depending if you're going to Denver. Now, what was pointed out is, you know, if I was a person who had a trading post and I wanted to sell you some pots and pans and something that you could find your gold in, I wanted you to come by my trading post. So there were all kind of bogus advertisements out there saying, don't listen to these guys. Smoky Hill's the way to go. It's much shorter, it was. Even had some kind of fabricated maps that made it shorter than it really was. Even the Republican is a shorter way to go to Denver and Pikes Peak and looping around in the Platte and in Arkansas. So some people did take them up on this. Some of those people didn't end up alive. It was really rough territory. These areas here had pretty good support along them because of all the travel that had gone over those routes in the 40s. They had built trading posts. Usually you didn't have to go. You couldn't even go a day without a trading post or someplace where you could get help. These here had not been traveled very much, much rougher country, and a lot of the Indians were set up in here, and they were, by this point, a little upset because they viewed this as their land, as their hunting ground. It was didn't escape then by 1860 that everything that they had was being stripped out and heavily competed for. So a lot of troubles erupted in there. So these here held their timber a little bit longer, and some of the accounts show the Republican and Smoky River scouting parties reporting into the 40s and even early 50s, a fair amount of timber left in them. They didn't just, you know, go out there. They did like most settlers would, and people who were out there to stay, they brought livestock. So cattle, oxen, horses, sheep. During that period, you're talking about a 20-year period, and this is an estimate, nobody really knows, but a 1.5 million of these fairly large draft animals moving. And this is the Platte. This isn't talking about the other river systems. Again, a lot of impact on the systems. So 1860, we've kind of gone through that. A lot of folks have come through. What started happening, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, it was pretty clear folks were out in the West to stay. And first, when you went, didn't find gold, well, you could set up a trading post. There are other ways to make a living with all those people coming through and finding gold, and they needed hotels, and there were many things. So Denver became a city in its own right. And the U.S. said, well, you know, we've got to protect the settlers now because the Indians are really not happy. There's a lot of violence out there. Began building forts out of wood. So what wood was left, a lot of that went into building forts to protect the settlers. Settlers themselves started saying, you know, I'm kind of tired. I don't need to go all the way to Denver. Looks pretty nice here in Grand Island. So you started seeing about 1860 and then on, people started to just kind of settle along the way. So instead of just moving through Nebraska to get to their riches, they began settling into places like Nebraska and Kansas and, you know, setting up and farming and staying put. Again, some of them built sod houses, but some of them built wood. Interested in firewood. You know, it was a very limited resource. Picture of Dodge City. Again, these are wooden structures here. And again, a sense of how fast things grew. 1870, not so much. Remember, the settlers until that point, they weren't interested in staying here. There was too much money to be made by going to Denver. 1875, a little bit, but 1880, really, really starting to put down some roots in Kansas and in places like Nebraska. This is representative of pretty much what it was, you know, people really, you know, setting up here now. And there's one more thing, the railroad. Transcontinental Railroad, when Lincoln crops. And you also have a lot of subsurface flow that goes into your stream that way too that you can take care of. So, you know, why trees? Why not just put grass on these streams? And